was no one flipping burgers. All the grills were cold. Onion rings were in their bags. Fries were growing mold. There were no baristas at Starbucks asking how many shots would you like when all the minimum wage workers went on strike.
Welcome to another edition of Raising San Radio. I'm your host, Susan Gallimore, with Dave Rovics and Minimum Wage Strike to introduce today's show as we head into the eighth year of war in Iraq and even longer, the war in Afghanistan. Saturday, March 20th, was yet another anniversary of the beginning of the bombardment of Iraq. And today we hear from Daniel Ellsberg, author of the Pentagon Papers, who spoke at Plumbers Hall in San Francisco about the connections between war and labor. This was at the invitation of the San Francisco Labor Council and the U.S. Labor Against the War. We also hear from Kerry Philp and Dr. Adrian Edmondson about their recent travels to Afghanistan. Daniel Ellsberg released the documents that became known collectively as the Pentagon Papers. At the time, he held an extremely high-level security clearance and was one of the very few individuals who had access to the complete set of documents that revealed that the government had knowledge all along that the war in Vietnam would not likely be won and that continuing the war would lead to many times more casualties than was ever admitted publicly. Further, the papers showed that the high-ranking officials had a deep cynicism toward the public, as well as disregard for the loss of life and injury suffered by soldiers and civilians. Here is Daniel Ellsberg speaking at Plumbers Hall in San Francisco on March 20th about the connections between war and labor at the invitation of the San Francisco Labor Council and U.S. Labor Against the War.
I'm particularly happy to be addressing this audience, and I'll explain why. It's been 40 years since I took part in a labor rally against the war. I've been lecturing and demonstrating. I've been arrested nearly 80 times over the last 40 years. This is the first time since 1970 that I've been invited to address labor against a war, and I'm very happy to see it. I think that people in this audience represent a force that would be seen by the Pentagon as the most dangerous force in America against their policies. You people can use your efforts to expand your numbers and your proportion, your influence within the labor movement altogether. I think somebody told me there was their local labor organization did not endorse this particular gathering or the march today. Well, that's nothing new. And if that could change, nothing could be more valuable. Let me give one little bit of personal history here before I got in the Marines, which was in 1954 to 57. I joined the UAW at the age of 17. Had to get my father's consent. Spent the summer, my first summer out of high school, working at the Dodge Plant Number 3 in Hamtramck, night shift, which I was interested to see years later was the first plant where the UAW negotiated working conditions. I lost my hearing, upper ranges of my hearing permanently working a punch press that one summer. I'm wearing hearing aids now as a result. My intention, the reason I did that, was that my intention was a life in labor at that time. I studied labor economics all through my Harvard years, till 52. And before that, as I say, I worked in the Dodge plant. As a kid, as a high school kid, I read In Dubious Battle by Steinbeck and The Grapes of Wrath, and a book by Louis Adamek, if any of you've ever seen that, called Dynamite, about the early labor struggles. And I researched the Memorial Day Massacre at Republic Steel in Chicago and the Battle of the Overpass involving the Ruther brothers, who were my heroes at that time. So I was going to be in labor, but it turned out that with the Berlin blockade in 1948, my senior year, and various other developments, I was recruited into the Cold War pretty thoroughly in my mind, as were a lot of people, and as was the labor movement around that time. Really, a lot of deals were made between Hubert Humphrey and the government and so forth to support NATO, to support militarization of the economy in many ways in return for government assistance in purging the unions of their more left-wing elements and the communist-led elements and unions like the UE, which were very progressive at that time, and others. Even the Ruther brothers benefited from that move at the time. They were my heroes, but it wasn't really a good development. I remember when I went to college, Operation Dixie, organizing the South, was supposedly on the agenda, and that ran into the ground somehow. I'd like to read more history about that. But movement moved away from increasing organization in the South and elsewhere. Just the equivalent of that today is in the world and globalization. But instead went toward pension funds and welfare and various other things. By the way, a lot of people have forgotten that Walter Ruther was a big proponent of health care, universal health insurance at that time. And part of the unions were pressing Truman for that movement back when I was in college, which we are not about to see the real culmination of it shortly, but maybe a step along the way now. The loss, the decrease, the decline of the labor movement in numbers, in proportion of jobs, and in political activism, political commitment over the generations now since I was a teenager, have probably been the major, factor in the demobilization, let's say, of the American public and the shift to the right of the Democratic Party and of the society as a whole. When we compare our societies in terms of health, education, other things to the social democratic governments in Europe, the difference is those social democratic governments are based on a major, powerful union movement. Another factor was, as I say, was they were recruited into the Cold War with people like George Meany. When I joined the Vietnam, anti-Vietnam War movement, having taken part in the Vietnam as a committed Cold Warrior, and then seeing through it eventually while I was in Vietnam and after I came back and read the Pentagon Papers and began speaking out, even before the Pentagon Papers came out, labor was on the other side on these demonstrations. Under George Meany, as I mentioned, people like Emil Mazie were shouted down, called communists and traitors when they spoke out at the CIO conventions. And we just weren't people in the movement, which was largely a youth movement then, coming out of the civil rights, were not at all accustomed to seeing labor side by side with them in demonstrations. Or on the contrary, Nixon was able to call on people to beat up demonstrators. Hard hat people, and they presented him with a hard hat in the Oval Office when he called them in to congratulate them, literally for beating up demonstrators in Wall Street and elsewhere in the 70s. So if there is a movement, and this is part of it, this is a good start, maybe it's more than a start, nothing could be more important, not only with respect to the war and our economy, but every kind of social movement here, unless we see a conversion of our government budget, our military budget, our society, away from war production and war making, we cannot solve any of the problems that face us in the world. And with the resources that would come from a real conversion, that means a conversion of jobs, in which labor has been a conservative force on the whole. The jobs right now in places like Southern California, especially in Connecticut and a lot of other places, are military jobs. And the idea of lowering the defense budget, which McGovern proposed, was immediately met with the fear that what's going to replace them, really, in those jobs. But the fact is that, as my wife has tried to say in front of Women's Move, she made a tremendous speech in front of the National Association Now, at one point, trying to convince them that the military budget is a woman's problem for two reasons. That none of the problems women are concerned about and none of the problems we as society are concerned about can be dealt with effectively as long as we're wasting this vast proportion of our money and the world's money on military production and war. And on the other hand, we can solve all the problems with the resources that go into even global warming, not in one year, but in the course of a number of years, you can literally deal with all those problems if you deal with the resources. But Obama comes out of a tradition, I think it's now recognizable, that the Clintons came out of, the Democratic Leadership Council, who were concerned a generation ago that a president would never again take the White House, a Democrat, unless he outdid the Republicans in spending on military spending. That's their core principle. And we're still hearing it from the Democratic Leadership Council people, and there's really no difference between Obama and the Clintons on this point, I'm sorry to say.
You're listening to Daniel Ellsberg at Plumbers Hall in San Francisco at the invitation of San Francisco Labor Council and U.S. Labor Against the War. This is Raising Sand Radio, and I'm Susan Gallimore, host of this hour-long weekly show, bringing in-depth progressive views and ideas. Let's return to Daniel Ellsberg.
Let me mention one aspect that where I seem to be living in a world all by myself, in a way, even with respect to anti-war people. And it comes out of my experience of counterinsurgency in Vietnam, which was my job there, evaluating counterinsurgency. And I went in 38 of the 43 provinces of Vietnam looking at pacification or counterinsurgency, working with people that I respected, who were brave people, a lot of whom even spoke Vietnamese, unlike most Americans. Thought of ourselves as the good guys. I wasn't one of the speakers, but I learned, Vietnamese speakers, but I learned from them. Just as the Air Force mistakenly believed that we could have won the war with more bombing, we only dropped more bombs on Indochina than four times what we dropped in all of World War II. And that's what the Air Force called fighting with one arm behind our back, right? And they thought a little McCain thinks to this day that they could have won the war with a little more bombing of North Vietnam. He didn't really learn a lot of insight in his prisoner of war camp. It was a brave experience for him, but not the place to really learn much about Vietnam. And on the other hand, the good guys, so-called, that I worked with, thought that if we'd really use counterinsurgency effectively, pacification, the kinds of things that McChrystal and Petraeus are pushing now in Afghanistan, that could have won the war. I came to believe, I was part of that school or that religion for quite a while. And I've trained under the great prophets of it, like Edward Lansdale. They were wrong. I was convinced, became convinced that they were wrong. Nothing could have won. Nothing really gave us a right to win in that country any more than in the other. But right or wrong, the prospects of it were nothing. The basic analogy between that war and what I now think of as Vietnamistan that we're fighting is that in both cases we're opposing people who were not saints by any means. They were not nonviolent. They used terrorism. They were, in the case of the Viet Cong, really Stalinist at the head, at the leadership. But their recruiting and their mobilization was based on expelling foreigners from their country, foreign occupation, as in Afghanistan. And I came to realize that they were not going to give up. They had a very strong nationalistic motivation. I think there is no prospect that we will achieve anything of any benefit to anybody in Afghanistan or us by our efforts in Afghanistan any more than the Soviets achieved any benefit in the 10 years in which they lost 15,000 men and a million Afghans died. With our encouragement to get that war started and keep it started, to bleed the Soviets. Well, it did bleed the Soviets, 15,000 troops. But when Brzezinski says that he told Carter when they went in, now we have the chance to give the Soviets their Vietnam, you know, to the detriment of the Soviet Empire. Nobody seems to have noticed that that involved giving the Afghans their Vietnam, and it cost them a million lives. And he kept that war going, as Charlie Wilson's war explains, really, in order to bleed the Soviets and bleed the Afghans 10-1, but nobody was noticing that. But we weren't interested in the Afghans, and we didn't care about the Afghans. So in order to kill some Soviet soldiers with weapons that we supplied, the fact that it was killing 10 times and more, many more, Afghans was not even in our calculations, any more than it is right now. Now, here's where I say I live in a somewhat different world from nearly everybody else. Most people have accepted in their calculations of cost over the next 10 years that there will be a ceiling of something like 100,000 troops, maybe 120,000 troops in Afghanistan, U.S. troops. And they get that directly from Obama, who says in his speech in December and again in his State of the Union speech that he will be withdrawing troops starting 18 months from now. And Gates has said, well, maybe 24 months from now. And maybe it won't be too many at first, it'll be slow. But the argument as to how long will it take to get them all out and so forth is a total distraction from the implicit promise that that's a ceiling, that this is the last escalation. Not a first installment, but the last escalation will be drawing down from that. I don't think there's any chance of that. Any chance. Now, I could be wrong. When I'm certain, I've been wrong before, and sometimes happily so, and I'd be happy if I were wrong about this. I'm just saying, as I see it, with Petraeus and McChrystal in place and their counterinsurgency strategy, which basically requires some 600,000 troops for a country the size of Afghanistan, where is he going to get those? We don't have a draft. We can't put 500,000 troops in as we did in Vietnam. We don't have a draft yet or now. If another 9/11, I think that'll change. He proposes to fill in the gap with the Afghan troops. But everybody who knows that situation and noticed that the Afghan army on our side that we're paying deserts at the rate of 25% a year, in other words, as fast as you can sign them up, they're not even going to get much above their present level, let alone double it or triple it. So where's the rest going to come from? Well, I would say from Iraq. Does that second point of the reality I'm talking about here? It's taken for granted in almost everything I read that Obama is going to carry out his promise to get all American troops out of Iraq at the end of 2011. All combat troops earlier than that, maybe this year, all troops out at the end of 2011. I don't think there is any chance of that. The world I live in my head, is that Obama intends and expects to have U.S. bases in Iraq as long as he's alive. Not just as long as he's in office, as long as his children are alive. If he won't be able to control that, but that would be a good prediction. When McCain says 100 years, and we've been 50 years in Germany and over and Japan, Korea, 100 years, he said, of course, without combat, which assumes that the Iraqis all come to accept the permanent presence of American bases in their country. Not very likely. So, but the time period is pretty good. How long do we want bases in Iraq? As long as the oil is there. As long as it's near Israel. And I don't know about the latter, but the oil will be there at least 100 years. I believe there is no chance that we will have less than 30,000 to 50,000 U.S. troops there at the end of Obama's second term, as things are now going. Now, is that a council then of despair? What's the use? We can't do anything about it. One thing to consider is what effect that has on the cost estimates that we're looking at here. Granted, they're trying to do most of it by air power, in Iraq especially, air power from those permanent bases that we're still building in Iraq, helicopters, bombers, whatnot, and less than raids. So the American casualties won't be necessarily very high. Just the Afghan casualties will be very high. But the cost, very great. It's not the $1 trillion they're talking about. Try doubling that. And the question we are asking here on these things is, can we really afford $1 trillion with the other things we need here, of infrastructure, health, education, and so forth? Try $2 trillion or $3 trillion, which, by the way, is the direction Stiglitz's predictions have been going anyway, when you consider a lot of other costs, like the veterans' benefits that will go on forever. As I say, I hardly see anybody who addresses that. It seems like too much of an accusation against Obama. Well, I'm too old to hold back that accusation now. Right. I'm saying Obama is lying to the same way and the same degree that my former president, Lyndon Johnson, lied. I repeat, in Afghanistan, more troops 4 years from now than he has 2 years from now. As he takes perhaps 100,000 troops of what we had a few months ago in Iraq. We're down maybe to 95,000 then, but we had about 135,000 earlier this year. Take 100,000 out of that, let them come home to kiss their husbands and their wives, and then they will go to Afghanistan, I believe. and Afghanistan, again, as I say, the numbers then will increase, while 30,000 remain in Iraq. So that's the cost we're really looking at. Now, granted, the case against this would seem to be comparably strong, just as strong without that, even if we were getting out of Iraq, or we were going to draw down in Afghanistan. The expense is still vast, to no good effect. And actually, I notice, I'm hearing myself, I've been saying to no one's benefit. That's obviously not true. It is to the benefit of warlords in Afghanistan, otherwise known as drug-dealing armed militias, drug dealers in Afghanistan, who, by the way, will be selling that heroin to our troops cheaply in Afghanistan the same way they did in Vietnam. And we're going to have among the casualties an awful lot of troops coming back with a heroin addiction if we need that, as well as heroin flooding into this country. But the warlords in this country, of course, do benefit very greatly. It's a minority. And the oil pipeline people, and the, and by the way, the oil pipeline, if you looked at that map, goes through the area that we are oddly concentrating on in Afghanistan right now, Helmand Province. Why are we clearing out Taliban from Helmand Province, where they've owned it forever, and essentially, and they're not going anywhere, they just don't want foreigners there? Because that's where the pipeline, if you look at the map again, will come right down to the ocean for UNICAL. Finish up here, my time is up. I'll say, who is going to get Congress to cut off the funding for these criminal, useless, unnecessary, bloody, hopeless wars? Who but labor? Who but labor? We don't have the youth movement we had then, for whatever reasons are involved. We don't have the labor movement against the war. We don't have the labor movement we had in the mid-40s and late 30s. But we do have a labor movement. Some people say churches should do it. I say, fine, get them in there if you can, but I don't see it. But I am addressing a labor group here, and I'm very happy to see it. And let's go to work. Thank you.
That was Daniel Ellsberg speaking about labor, war, and leadership, sponsored by the San Francisco Labor Council and U.S. Labor Against the War. There was a brief question and answer session during which Ellsberg shared his view on labor leaders and lobbyists.
Well, it's been a long time that I would say labor's, the interests of laborers, the labor and the union workers, have not been well represented by their lobbyists and their leaders in Washington. And it isn't just a matter of certain unions that are mobbed up and that needed to be taken over at a certain point, like as the Teamsters were for a while and some others. It's a matter in general of lower of the people in the unions, I would say, beginning to struggle against their own current leadership. And you have, to, of course, some good leaders, especially recently. But I keep mentioning George Meany. I'm kind of bitter about that part of my life, which had meant to be my main life. He just signed up so heavily on the anti-communism and the world and the Cold War that he gave away a lot of the interests of working people. If the leaders are not representing you properly, it's just like the Jews in this country who allow themselves to be represented by AIPAC and by the Likud Party. For years, I've been saying, you've got to work within your own house to start with. And that's with labor, or it's with the Jews. I've been saying for years, when a Jew like myself criticizes Likud or the current leadership of in Israel, you're sure to be called a self-hating Jew. Well, I brush that off. That's ridiculous as far as I'm concerned. But if somebody called me a self-hating Democrat, I'd find that hard to refute.
Again, this is Daniel Ellsberg, and another member of the audience asked his view about union busting.
Thanks for talking, Daniel, about the early period of the merger of the AFL-CIO and what happened to the unions, because it's interesting. Today, there's a mass protest in Washington, but it's not by the unions. It's by the teabaggers. And it's getting national publicity, as a matter of fact, against any kind of program of reform of the healthcare system, although I don't support the healthcare system. The question is for you and for the audience here, what is labor going to do? Because labor does have the power. The teachers have faced mass layoffs, hundreds of thousands of teachers throughout the country. There's no united campaign to bring a million teachers to Washington, D.C. against union busting by our government. So I think that the people are looking for labor to really do what it should be doing and what it did in the 30s, but unfortunately that action is not taking place, and that's, I think, the political problem that labor has to face.
Okay. Thanks. Incidentally, thanks for mentioning the teabaggers. It ties in, of course, with what I was saying earlier. I'm not being funny here when I say that, or just metaphorical, there are lessons to learn from the extreme right wing in terms of organization to some extent. Yeah, they are showing activism right now, and it is a shame that we should see the activism on that extreme right now and not on our side. You know, they're the attitude of the Goldwater people was just crazy as far as I'm concerned. And yet, they were patient, tenacious, they worked over years, and they were effective politically. And we can learn from what they did. And there's other techniques as well. Now, on our side, I've been trying up here to remember this last thing I was at. I said a labor thing, which was against the war. It was, I just remember, Harold Gibbons, remember him? From the Teamsters. The name came back to me. And I remember an exchange I had with him. I was there to try to persuade him to take part in the what came to be May Day demonstrations in 1971, just before the Pentagon Papers came out, where they tried to close down Washington. There were some related actions like that, sit in the streets and close down Washington if they wouldn't stop the war. And I remember Gibbons, who was very good against the war, but he actually got up and said, "Well, you know, we in the labor movement don't really endorse civil disobedience." And I had to say, "Hey, wait a minute." My memory, I grew up in Detroit, you know, my memory is that the labor movement invented something called a sit-down strike, actually found unconstitutional by the U.S. Supreme Court, but not before it had organized the steel and autos. It was tremendously effective. And to come up closer to the present, something I don't have time to go into now, but I urge you to look into it. In 1969, there was a movement called the Moratorium, which was really a general strike. It was a weekday set of demonstrations all across the country, like today, by the way, to some extent. But 2 million people counted, 10 here, 1,000 there, 100,000 in New York, 75,000 in San Francisco. But there they added up to 2 million people. Nobody knew it at the time, but that was keeping Nixon from carrying out a massive escalation that he had explicitly threatened to North Vietnam for that time exactly, and he couldn't do it. It was the most effective action ever done, probably in any country, against any war, and it prevented even the use of nuclear weapons for which he'd chosen targets in 1969, plus invasion of Laos and Cambodia, North Vietnam, Myanmar, Haiphong, and so forth. So strike, you know, that is our major tool here, after all. And to close, are your leaders in your organizations using the pressure they represent from you, the money and the votes, campaigning, the way you think they should? If you can't change your own leadership's policy, how are you going to change the U.S. government policy?
When the dust all settled, the sun shone so bright, and a great calm took over us like it was all gonna be alright. That's how it felt to be alive after the revolution.
Dave Rovics and After the Revolution, following Daniel Ellsberg speaking about labor, war, and leadership, an event sponsored by the San Francisco Labor Council and U.S. Labor Against the War. If you'd like to listen to the entire event, which also featured a 10-minute version of the film Why Are We in Afghanistan, you can contact the San Francisco Labor Council at 415-440-4809. Let me give you that again. For the full, I think it's a couple of hours, 3 or 4 hours worth of this event, 415-440-4809. Thanks to Joseph Woodard Multimedia for sharing this recording. And you can contact Joseph Woodard Multimedia directly at 510-748-9811. 510-748-9811. Now we turn to the conflict zone in Afghanistan. Kerry Philp and Dr. Adrian Admonson recently returned from a trip to learn about that country firsthand. It's my great pleasure to welcome to Raising Sand Radio, Kerry Philp. Welcome.
Thank you.
It's great to have you with us. You have just returned from a trip to Afghanistan through Global Exchange, a reality tour, I believe.
That's right.
And Kerry, why did you go to Afghanistan to start there?
I hadn't been on a vacation in quite some time, to be quite honest. And I had sort of been feeling as if I needed a trip that had a little bit more of a purpose to it. A friend had sent me some links to Global Exchange. I really enjoyed the concept. I thought it was quite clever and quite meaningful. And so whenever I went on Global Exchange's website and looked at the countries, I was kind of surprised that Afghanistan was one of them. And when I clicked on the link to the program description, I just kind of got a chill by the title, which was all about women making change, and knew pretty much instantly that this was the program that I wanted to do.
And what kind of work do you normally do?
I work for a nonprofit organization called Schwab Charitable, and I provide both marketing and business development support to the organization, which is a leading national provider of philanthropic services.
What did you think before you went? What did you think you were going to be getting into?
By talking to two prior participants of this delegation, I knew that I would be going from one organization to another. We would be traveling and meeting with different people who were involved in women's issues. And we're helping to develop the country and learn about some of the challenges that are involved in that. So I had an idea that the days would probably be pretty packed visiting different people and different organizations, and that was definitely the case. It was a jam-packed itinerary, which was fabulous. So we really got a nice overview of a lot of the different issues that exist in Afghanistan.
And was this the first time you'd been to a country like Afghanistan, a third world country, as we would call them here?
It's not. I was a Peace Corps volunteer in Albania and in Guinea in West Africa, where I was an English teacher for 2 years. I also did a semester abroad in Costa Rica during college, studying sustainable development. But it had just been a while since I had traveled to a developing country.
Mm. You were mostly in Kabul.
That's right. The majority of our program was based in Kabul. We went to a village for an afternoon called Istalif. So we were outside of Kabul a little bit, but the majority of the trip was based in the city. Upon arriving at the airport, I would say incredibly beautiful landscape, enormous military presence, especially at the airport, and a city that is a bit at a crossroads. There's a lot of development taking place, but you also see many signs of 30 years of war that this country has endured.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of bombed out buildings, roads in very bad state, lots of potholes, lots of mud, horrible infrastructure.
And how do the people look?
Well, I think everyone's going to have their opinion about that. I felt that people were, surprisingly, they were so welcoming, for one. I think that there are people who are optimistic, but I got a lot of the sense from people, just from their energy, that a lot of it is just day-to-day. It's really kind of getting from one day to the next. But with that being said, they were warm, incredibly welcoming, amazing hospitality.
Can you talk about some of the people that you visited with, some of the groups?
The trip was sponsored by an organization called Afghans for Tomorrow. And myself and my 11 other colleagues stayed at their guest house, which is in the western part of the city. A lot of the people that we talked to were, for one, they were members of Afghans for Tomorrow, whether board members, executive director, and then we visited their school, one of the girls' schools that they have up and running. And so we visited with the principal, and we visited the classrooms of the school. We spoke with the girls of the school, who introduced themselves in English to us. We met with some human rights organizations and activists. We met with a conservation NGO We met with a woman, a director of a maternity hospital, and toured the hospital. There were some cultural aspects to the tour as well. We went to the museum and visited some palaces.
At some level, it sounds as though the experiences that you had there are a little bit at odds with some of what we see in the newspapers. It sounds much a lot of war going on in that area, but it sounds from your experience that's not necessarily the case.
You know, there was a lot of apprehension about this trip, and the apprehension was not from me. It was from, you know, friends and coworkers who were very concerned. And part of that is because of really what we know about Afghanistan, and that's basically what we read and what we see on television. The experience that I had there could not have been further from that. Now, with that being said, I'm not saying that bombings don't occur, because they do. And in fact, there was a bomb that went off while I was there. I slept through it. I didn't hear it. And it was far enough away, and we were not a target of that. There was not one point where I felt that my life was threatened in any way, or that there was any animosity towards me as an American or as a foreigner from Afghans.
What would you like people to know? Would you suggest that people go there to see for themselves?
I think the biggest surprise for me and the biggest thing that people should know is that out of all of the Afghans that we talked to, I think just about every one of them said that foreign presence, that foreign military presence is welcomed and it is necessary in order to have peace. It's the one thing that Afghans need. They need to have peace in this country, and they need the military to do that. They need this kind of security. Now, with that being said, they also said that what they need most from foreigners and from their own government is honesty. And they need development, and they need infrastructure. And the model that we're currently using is not working. And the reason for that is because the funds that come in from international aid organizations, for one, it's not as much as they've been promised. So there's less money that they're dealing with when it comes to development. Then the next thing that happens when the money comes in is that a portion of it goes towards security. So, and it's usually a pretty big portion. They also use outside contractors to do the development work. So that money is for one, it's not going directly to an Afghan NGO, but number two, and more importantly, it's not actually building capacity for the country. Mm-hmm. So that's the biggest thing that Afghans need besides peace and stability, is that they need human capacity. So all of the skills that Afghans have built, they all left, you know, and they've been gone for 30 years during the war, and they haven't returned. So people need to develop skills and develop capacity. So that's a big, big issue. And it's one of the things that we heard repeatedly throughout trip was, you know, that money needs to come to Afghan NGOs and other organizations that we trust and that really understand the landscape and what needs to be done. And it's not getting there. And, you know, it also gets funneled through the government. And so even more is taken away. So we see very, very little of that aid money that comes in.
And how do you think it's possible to pressure the administration here to hear that message a little more thoroughly?
I think probably the best thing that we can do is talk to our congressmen, for one. I think it's just really education and trying to develop a level of understanding. And I think we need to urge, you know, politicians, and we need to get international aid organizations to understand that we need to listen to what Afghans need. They don't look at foreign presence as occupation, number one. They don't see us that way, but they know that we have a really important role to play. But, you know, when it comes to development efforts, it's just something that they're not seeing. So I think we need to really just have conversations with politicians and with international organizations. I think maybe even through, you know, both television and newspaper, just getting the word out, that it's just really important to talk to organizations who are there and that are doing the work and are most in touch with Afghan people. The thing that was really interesting about being in Afghanistan is we met with a woman parliamentarian, and I asked her a question about the upcoming parliamentary elections in Afghanistan, and I asked her, what outcome are you most hoping for? Now, I think when we ask that question, what comes to mind is results. We think about candidates that we want in office. We think about initiatives that we want to see. Her response was very telling. She wanted two things to happen, and the first one being that she wanted the elections to be fair, and the second being that she wanted a great turnout. And it was very telling to me about what the mindset is right now in Afghanistan. And it's not necessarily about thinking way into the future. It's really about the present moment. And that was a great example when she said that. I thought, you know, here is a country that's really focusing day to day. And for her, a great election is not one in which certain candidates are elected, but it's one in which people are involved and that their vote is fair and that it's heard.
And do you think that that's possible?
I'm not really sure. We didn't ask what the probability of that was like, and I'm not familiar myself about what kinds of efforts are going on to ensure a fair election and a good turnout.
And what is the general feeling with the people that you did talk to about Karzai?
I think it depended on who you talked to, but you know, I think some people, you know, parliamentarians in particular are, you know, I think that they're optimistic. They're doing as much as they can. Other people might say that, you know, Karzai's not doing a good job, that he's more of what they refer to as the mayor of Afghanistan, not so much the president.
Well, the mayor of Kabul.
But not so much the president of Afghanistan.
Right.
So while we were there for a women's celebration, and he was supposed to speak, and he didn't show up. And we found out later that the reason why was because he was in Kandahar with General McChrystal, and he was talking to a group of elders at a mosque, and the elders definitely were not pleased with the work that he was doing. Mm-hmm. So I think that was an article that was in the New York Times that I read while I was there.
Carrie Philp, is there anything else you would like us to know?
Well, I mean, the big thing for me was, you know, it's a beautiful country with beautiful people, and everybody wanted our help. Everybody asked us, what can you do? Is there anything that you can do for us at this moment? And I wouldn't say in desperation, but just they saw us as a resource, and I felt incredibly responsible leading this trip. So, you know, I want people to really understand that to talk to people who've been there, you know, not just getting their information about Afghanistan necessarily from, you know, major newspapers or television. It's not the whole story. There's a lot more about Afghanistan, and that story really needs to be told. So to really get in touch with nonprofit organizations who are based here in the United States doing work there or are based in Afghanistan directly and really, you know, get to understand what the issues are and talk to them directly. You know, there are a lot of different opinions about what we should do about our involvement in Afghanistan. And like I said, we do need to be there. I don't know what that looks like necessarily. I don't know how many troops that's going to take, but stability is the number one goal for Afghans. And number two, a close second, is development. And those are the two things that we need to focus on. And we need to listen to Afghans to understand, you know, how that needs to be done, and we need to help them build skills and resources.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for being with us. Carrie Philp on her recent trip to Afghanistan. Now we turn to Dr. Adrian Amundsen. Both these interviews were pre-recorded. It's my great pleasure to welcome Dr. Adrian Amundsen. It's great to have you with us.
Yeah, glad to talk with you.
You were part of the Global Exchange delegation that just returned from Afghanistan, and we've done a lot of shows on Afghanistan from a lot of different angles, from archaeology, from religion, from war, and I'm really glad to have you with us to help our listeners understand about what's going on there at this point. So let's start off with, how did you decide to go on this trip to this war zone?
I have really been drawn to Afghanistan for about 12 years because it began to appear in art that I was making. The year before 9/11, I did some sculpture pieces that included an Afghan orphan, and I had no idea why. And then after 9/11, of course, Afghanistan was such an international focus, and I was so determined to become more politically educated and active again after having kind of put that a little bit aside while doing my work as a psychologist. I became much more politically active again as I had been in college. I was active in nonviolent political actions. And so Afghanistan seemed like a reasonable place to focus, since that's where everything was kind of coming into play. And the more I read, the more fascinated I was, the more intrigued I became by the country. Of course, the more disturbed I became about their having been overrun by one empire after another, and now us. And it was very painful. And when I noticed back then, or in the early 90s, that Global Exchange was doing a trip there, and I felt immediately certain that I had to go. And my kids were younger then, and when I mentioned this, they were quite adamant. They usually say, you know, whatever you want to do, Mom, that's fine. But they said, no way, Jose, you can't go to Afghanistan. And so I shelved it. I didn't want them to be scared. But it never went away. I became refocused on the trip when Code Pink did a trip in the fall, and I was pretty much set to do that as a peace delegation, but it various things interfered. And it continued to be just a pull for me. I just felt compelled to get there and see what was really happening, what it was really like for people, what people there really had to say about the impact of the American military and 30 years of nonstop war. And I wanted to get a sense of what their needs were, to see if there was anything I or the people I know could do to contribute to the healing that the people in the country are so badly in need of after being destroyed again and again and again. So it started with this calling from my art. It became more and more political. And actually, it's back to my art now, because I really hope, for me personally, I hope to be able to write about it and bring other people into the experience of being there and share information about organizations that are providing services and trying to help with development, because I know people want to plug in and be helpful.
From the point of view of a psychologist, what did you notice? It sounds like you didn't actually get together with other psychologists.
No, we didn't. We did meet with several doctors, and we met with someone who works with Afghans for Tomorrow, which was one of our sponsoring organizations. Very knowledgeable woman, originally from India, who lives in America now. And she was the person who seemed most knowledgeable about the psychological issues in the country. And what she told us was, and I did hear this echoed from several other people, that there is at least a 60% depression rate in the country. And an immeasurable rate of PTSD. And I don't see how that could not be true, after given what they've been through and the danger and the poverty and the lack of comfort that the people are living with now. So I know that there is almost certainly very high rates of depression and PTSD. And this woman also told us that there were only 10 psychologists in the country.
That's just astonishing.
Isn't that astounding?
Yeah.
And my guess would be that they have virtually no medications, because of what we heard in other medical settings. For example, in the maternity hospital, I sort of naively asked if they tended to do medicated or unmedicated births, and their reply was they did unmedicated births because they still didn't have medication. And they were really hoping to get pain meds by the spring. This is a hospital that's been in operation for some time. So my guess is they don't have services, they don't have meds, they certainly don't have psychological treatment. I have several contacts from whom I hope to find out more specific information.
Earlier we talked with Carrie Philippe, and she said that there was such a sense of welcoming to all visitors coming over. Did you see signs of psychological trauma from the point of view of being a psychologist?
Well, that's a very good question. You know, the people that we were introduced to were people who were very actively providing services and very prepared to meet us, and they were strong and warm and welcoming and determined. So I think that was probably a very particular slice of the population.
Uh-huh, right.
The people we met informally also still seemed, I would say not hopeless, but determined to help bring changes to the country. But when you talked with them longer and kind of got past the initial layers, I did hear from everybody that it was very discouraging and that they knew many people who were becoming increasingly hopeless. And several people made a point of saying that whereas maybe 4 years ago there was an increase in optimism about things improving, but that there was more hopelessness now. Things were not improving, and they heard from more people that they just wanted to get out of the country. So my sense, that what I picked up was a sense of that kind of, you know, the helplessness and depression that comes when you're repeatedly defeated in your efforts. I did not talk to people who were evidencing war trauma, but the streets are filled with people who are living in absolute intolerable circumstances, and my guess is that there's probably a high rate of suicide and a high rate of the kind of thing you see when people are traumatized, you know, anger problems, despair, and I wouldn't be surprised if domestic violence is a problem.
I think that I've seen that that's escalated a lot, too. I also understand from my own research that there are about 70,000 widows in Kabul alone, about 2 million across the country, and a lot of these women are simply not educated, so they're not able to feed their children easily. And so I suppose you're seeing a lot of kids on the street.
Oh, yeah. Oh, my God. So many kids on the street. Oh, so many kids on the street. And so many sad women on the street, you know, just sitting there selling one or two things, sitting in the mud, trying to sell a loaf of bread, trying to, you know, sell a few small handicrafts. Kids are running wild. You know, we visited a great program that is trying to provide vocational training for these, they call them the street vending kids, not the street kids. They're the kids who sell stuff on the streets and run after you and try to, you know, get you to give them money for the holy smoke in the cans and the gum and the cigarettes. And I, you know, there was definitely a rough edge to those kinds of, to what I saw there. Yeah, and they're just, I mean, they're kids on the street everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And I think mothers in despair because mothers, more than anything, want to take care of their kids. They want their kids to be okay.
There's also been an increase in sexual trafficking of young women, I hear, and the same as it's been in Iraq and particularly with the refugees in Syria. Any of that obvious to you?
It was not obvious to me, but I have also heard that that's true, and I would like to find out more about that.
Mm-hmm.
It seems like sex trafficking is just increasing everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you do hear about, we did hear about, in kind of anecdotal ways, about families feeling forced to sell their children.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind our listeners that we're talking with Dr. Adrian Amudson. And I'm actually wanting to go back now to what you said earlier in our conversation. You mentioned that you had been politically active as a young college person, and then you had turned away from that, and then you came back again. And I think this is certainly a cycle that I myself went through, but I think it's a cycle that a lot of people have been going through in the last couple of decades.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't say I ever completely turned away from it. I kept, you know, my political values were very strong, but at a certain point in my political involvement in college, I found that it was a pretty extroverted activity, and that my skills and my inclination really lay a lot more clearly in the smaller arena, mm-hmm. dealing with individuals and uh-huh. families, and I decided that would be the way I could make a contribution to the world, maybe with more impact than by being as politically active as I was in college and for the several years after. I was involved in putting together a co-op on my campus for the study of nonviolence, and I would say that impacted my values and my worldview. But you know, in the Bush years, I mean, you just couldn't not pay attention.
<I know. laughs> It's the one
so
thing he
horrible.
Really did. Yeah, he really re-radicalized a lot of people.
Oh,
yeah.
He did. And I had boys who were going to be of draft age. And, you know, send your kids to wars like these, that's just crazy. And, you know, the political rhetoric became more and more polarizing that way.
Afghanistan has an incredibly rich and complex history,
yes.
and incredibly rich and complex archaeology,
yes.
and it gets short shrift here in the coverage of the war, which is so dismal. What are the sorts of things that you would like people to know about the country?
Well, you know, I think in a way, the more you know about Afghanistan, the more you know about world history, and in a way, the shadow side of all of world history, you know, empires clashing and this country being the battleground. So it's extremely enlightening to pay attention to that when you're looking, if you have concerns about what the great powers are doing and have been doing for a very long
time. Very long time.
So you get a very big context. And I think that really opens your mind to thinking on a pretty large level about what needs to change on the planet. You sort of have to have a global perspective when you're in Afghanistan. It's an incredibly interesting culture. The people are really warm, and I have a feeling that the strength of the extended family structure there is part of what's helped them be as resilient as
mm-hmm.
they are.
Mm-hmm.
There was an extraordinary spirit and resilience in the women that we met. They're just, I met a 20-year-old girl who wants to be president. She's already got a project going to teach men to treat women better.
Hmm.
And I think there's something very inspiring and uplifting about seeing that in such a devastated, absolutely devastated part of the world. If you have any questions about the impact of military solutions to international problems, I think looking at Kabul will make you rethink that. But I'd absolutely recommend that people look at Global Exchange's reality tours, which is what this was. I feel deeply enriched by this experience, and I think I'm only just beginning to figure out what I learned.
I'm actually going to give a plug for the Berkeley Bamyan Education Foundation also.
Oh, good.
They're predominantly in the Bamyan Valley, which is in the Hazarajat. It's the Hazara people, too, which tend to be somewhat discriminated against in that country.
And Afghans for Tomorrow. That's four. They do the four as a number, as
mm-hmm.
a numeral.
Well, thank you so much for being with us.
Your pleasure.
Dr. Adrienne Upmanson sharing her views and experiences after a recent trip to Afghanistan. And that is our show for this week. Visit Raising Sand Radio website at raisingsandradio.org to download any of our shows, including many that offer a richer view of Afghanistan. Raising Sand Radio is now totally listener-sponsored, which means we can bring a wider range of progressive voices and views with your assistance. So contact me at susan@raisingsandradio.org with news in your communities that you think needs to be shared. What is going on in your community with labor or citizens taking trips that shine a different light on topics than is shared in the mainstream media? And we'll go out with Dave Rovics again, and this time strike a blow against the empire.
When the rich man